Chapter 8. The thick stone walls could not absorb her screams. The walls soaked up the heat of the sun until the rock was too hot to touch, but they let Susan Dunleavy's tortured wailing echo almost as if she were in the next cell. At first, Jeff Merrick had forced himself to listen, as if bearing witness to her pain could somehow give the young woman comfort. He had stoically endured her piercing shrieks for an hour, flinching each time she hit a note of agony so high it felt like his skull would shatter like a piece of crystal. Now, as he sat on the earthen floor of his cell, he held his hands clamped over his ears and hummed to drown out her cries. They'd taken her just after dawn, when the prison had yet to become stifling and the light through the room's single glassless window high on the east wall still held promise. The cell block measured at least 50 feet square and at least 30 feet high. It was divided into numerous jail cells, with stone walls on three sides and iron bars for the fourth and the ceiling. A second and third tier of cells ringed the room above him, accessible by wrought iron circular stairways. Despite the apparent antiquity of the facility, the iron bars were as secure as a modern supermax prison. Merrick had yet to see any of his captors' faces. They'd worn ski masks when they rammed his car off the road just outside his laboratory and on the flight to this hellhole. There were at least three of them, he knew, because of differences in their bodies. One was large and hulking and wore nothing but sleeveless athletic t-shirts. Another was slender and had bright blue eyes, while the third was distinguishable because he wasn't the other two. In the 3 days since the abduction, their jailers hadn't spoken a single word to either of them. They'd been stripped in the van that had smashed into their cars and given jumpsuits to wear. All their jewelry was removed, and instead of shoes, they had rubber flip-flops. They were given two meals a day, and Merrick's cell had a hole in the floor for a toilet that blew hot air and sand whenever the wind picked up outside. Since being dumped into the prison, the jailers had only come around to feed them. Then this morning, they came for Susan. Because her cell was on another row within the block, Merrick couldn't be sure, but it had sounded as if they'd yanked her to her feet by her hair. They had bundled her past him on their way out the room's lone door, a thick metal affair with peepholes. Susan was pale, her eyes already sheened over with despair. He had called her name and rushed his bars in an effort to touch her, to give her a token of human compassion, but the smallest guard smashed the bars with a nightstick. Merrick fell back helpless as they dragged her away. Estimating the heat that had built in the room, he believed 4 hours had passed since then. It had been quiet at first, and then the screams came. And now Susan was well into her second hour of torture. In the first hours of their kidnapping, Merrick had been certain this was about money, that their captors would demand cash in exchange for their release. He knew the Swiss authorities had a zero-tolerance policy when dealing with hostage takers, but he also knew there were companies that specialized in negotiating with kidnappers. Because of the recent spate of abductions in Italy, Merrick had instructed his board of directors to find such negotiators, if he were ever taken, and secure his freedom no matter the cost. But after being flown blindfolded for at least 6 hours, Merrick didn't know what was going on. He and Susan had whispered to each other late at night, speculating on their captor's intentions. While Susan insisted it had to be about his money and she was caught up in the abduction as a witness, Merrick wasn't so sure. He hadn't been asked to speak to anyone in the company about getting a ransom together or been given any indication that his people even knew he and Susan were still alive. Nothing so far fit what he knew about kidnapping. Admittedly, the rudimentary executive security course he'd taken had been years ago, but he recalled enough to know his abductors did not fit the usual profile. And now this. They were torturing poor Susan Dunleavy, a loyal, dedicated employee who knew little beyond her test tubes and beakers. Merrick recalled their conversation a few weeks back about her idea of ending oil spills with her trick plankton. He hadn't told her that while her goals were indeed lofty, her concept seemed a bit outlandish. His whole speech about revenge being a great motivator was just that, a speech, one he'd given 100 times in 100 variations. She'd have better luck overcoming a childhood trauma with a psychiatrist than in her laboratory. Thinking about her project made him consider all the other research currently underway at Merrick Singer. He'd done this many times since landing in the cell. There was nothing, absolutely nothing they were working on that would warrant what was happening if this was a case of industrial espionage. They weren't close to patenting anything new or revolutionary. In fact, they hadn't had a really profitable patent since he and Dan Singer first marketed their sulfur scrubbers. The company was basically a vanity project for him now, a way to keep his hands in the world of research chemistry and to get invitations to speak at symposiums. The screaming stopped. It wasn't a slow wind down, but a sudden cessation of sound that was more horrifying in its implications. Jeff Merrick shot to his feet, wedging his face into the iron bars so he could see a sliver of the cell block door. A few minutes later, the bolts shot back and the heavy slab of metal creaked open. They had to drag her in with her arms draped over two of the guards' necks, while the third held a set of large keys. As they drew near, Merrick saw blood caked in Susan Dunleavy's hair. Her jumpsuit had been torn at the neck, and the skin of her upper chest and shoulder was livid purple. She managed to look up as they dragged her past his cage. Merrick gasped. Her face was a pulped ruin. One eye was swollen closed while she could barely lever open the other against the weight of bruising. Blood and saliva ran in ropes from her split and slack lips. There was just the slightest flicker of life in her eye when she glanced at him.
"Dear God, Susan, I am so sorry."
He didn't try to fight his tears. She had become so pitiable a figure that he would have cried even if she were a total stranger. That she was an employee and that he was somehow responsible for what they had done to her tore at his soul. She spat a red glob onto the stone floor and croaked,
"They didn't even ask me any questions."
"You bastards," he raged at the guards. "I will pay you anything. You didn't need to do this to her. She's innocent." They might as well have been deaf because they gave no reaction to his outburst. They just dragged her from his view. He heard her cell door open and her dumped roughly inside. The iron door was slammed shut and the lock re-engaged. Merrick decided that when they came for him, he was going to fight them with everything he had. If he was going to be beaten, he wanted to inflict some punishment first. He waited in his cell for them, his fists balled, his shoulders tense and ready. The slightest guard, the one with the bright blue eyes, appeared. He held something in his hand, and before Merrick could identify it or react, the guard fired. It was a taser that pumped 50,000 volts into his body and overrode his central nervous system in a blaze of pain. Merrick went rigid for a second and then collapsed. By the time he regained consciousness, they had him out of the cell and almost to the main door. In such agony from the blast of electricity, he'd lost all thought of fighting them.